Yeah, I think it's an interesting concept. I'm not sure if I entirely agree with the premise, but I thought the concept was interesting.
Somewhat of a confronting topic, I guess you could say.
Well, I've never read anything like that before. Like this book was pretty new to me.
It's quite big, I feel. Like you can understand a lot of the things that you never understand back then.
Because it's so complex, there's so many and it's new thinking
Yes.
to obviously
Yeah.
most people. And so there's a lot to digest.
It's because the subject matter is not known to you, so it's a bit like a discovery.
It really gripped me. I didn't expect it to.
I was really interested. Oh, it really spoke to me.
It's certainly confrontational. It's material and ideas that I've not come across before, I'll be honest. And it is leading one to take a view of the world quite contrary to the one that I spent 50 odd years growing up with. So
There's a certain itch while I'm reading going, I know I can sort of, there's
yeah.
something here. I can really see something here. And that's what I liked about it. It's like when Socrates was asked about what's the role of a philosopher, he said it was the dragonfly for humanity, and that it just sort of
Buzzes around.
buzzes and pokes at them to annoy them, to make them think. That's what this book
Yeah.
is.
It was so dramatic, you know, these dramatic exclamation statements where, you know, other sources were, you know, not just said to be invalid, but actually kind of criticized. I mean,
There hasn't been books sort of like that in a very long time. Even the ones similar that make thought-provoking, and it's been a long time since, like maybe 15 years since I've really read something that inspired you just in this kind of vein of
Yeah.
really wanting to get to the bottom of and questioning human beings and their actions.
I found it quite easy to understand and really engaging. Actually, I really like the book.
It's good. I want to read more. I want to read more.
So how do I get the reader, reconnect the reader to the this historic fear of this human condition? Because unless I can do that, then they're not going to be in a position to follow the argument and make sense of human behavior and reach this deeper understanding that supposedly the book has at the end of it, or actually not in chapter two. So that's my dilemma, my problem in the presentation. So I mean, it's like, you know, you'd written a book about there's a tribe or something that suffers from a phobia of snakes, right? But they're not aware that is. And when I say, you know, well, why are you living indoors all day long, you know? And they said, oh, well, I like carpets, I like square walls, and, you know, I like walking through doorways, and, you know, and in fact, you know, walking through doorways is what made humans stand up and become bipedal in the first place. They've got all these theories based on, they're not in denial of this, that they've got this phobia. So I write this book about snakes to try to reconnect them to that phobia in order to, because this book supposedly will heal them of their phobia. So I've got to reconnect them to it. So I write this book about snakes, phobia. And I show, you know, it's all this book about snakes. And then, so I write this book, it'll supposedly heal them of snake phobia. And I give it to them. And they pick it up and then they open it and they go, I'm not going to read that. Psychologically, that's what happens. Like, it's impenetrable. So then I'm left scratching, well, how the hell am I ever going to try to get them to get the benefit of this insight? Because this whole insight into their behavior is based on becoming aware that this phobia actually exists in humans. And because until I can do that, I'm not going to make any progress. If I can connect humans with the possibility that they actually do suffer from this phobia, and then I can start using that fear of the human condition to begin to now have, let, now let's look at all the issues about human behavior from this perspective that we're living in fearful denial of this subject, then you can follow the argument because you've got some sense of the possibility that we actually do suffer from this horrific fear. And in fact, so that's what I do. So the book begins, the best way I know to connect people with the existence of this terrifying fear that we're obviously living in denial of, you can't face it, is this process of resignation. you know, we must have had an instinctive orientation like other animals once before we got a conscious mind, some 2 million years ago. Then we get a conscious mind, which is a different sort of information process. It needs to understand cause and effect. So the gene-based learning system can give species orientations. Some, you know, I use the example of migrating storks, you know, and they learned not to fly across the Sahara, not through an understanding, but the ones that were genetically made up that tried to fly that path got frizzled. So now that through natural selection, they all fly around the coast. They've got an instinctive orientation, but it's not an understanding. So where you put a conscious mind on one of these storks, we call him, anyway, you see it in chapter 2. You know, this stork, we call him Adam Stork, because it's similar to the story of the Garden of Eden with a different ending. You know, because in the Garden of Eden, we take the fruit from the tree of knowledge, become conscious. We're living in the Garden of Eden, this sort of innocent pre-human condition, innocent state. Then we take the fruit from the tree of knowledge, become conscious. And then in that story, it says we're evil and get chucked out of the Garden of Eden. But so we're going to watch old Adam Stork now. We put a conscious brain in his head and see what happens. So he's flying along and starts thinking to himself, I'll fly down to that island. Why not? No understandings yet. I've got to find his understanding by experimenting. So he heads off towards the island. And you can see him sort of hesitate because his instincts are going to try to pull him back onto the flight path that goes over the island. And he's in a dilemma. Either he gives in to his instincts and never finds knowledge, or he courageously defies his instincts and perseveres with his search for knowledge. Of course he's got to persevere. He's got to have the courage to persevere in spite of his instincts being intolerant of those. So anyway, old Adam Stork, the only way he can cope with being criticised is to block them out, get angry with the bloody things, and try to prove them wrong, that he's not bad. He becomes angry, egocentric and alienated, which is the essential state of our corrupted human condition. But if you stand back and look at that story, who's the hero? Old Adam Stork had the guts and courage, like it says in The Man of La Mancha, that musical, you know. We had to be prepared to march into hell for a heavenly cause. It's very paradoxical. We had to lose ourselves to find ourselves. We had to march into hell, suffer becoming corrupted, in order to find understanding that would end our corruption through understanding. Because old Adam Stork's never going to free himself from this condemnation until he could sit down with his instincts and explain why, from first principle biological, why he had to fly off course. So you get it, instincts, I'm good, not bad after all. Get off my case, okay? So then no longer does he have to get angry and block out his criticism because he's defended. That's why it transforms you, chapter 2, because it'll bring the explanation that we've been in search of since we first became conscious beings. So just to go through that resignation, there's lots of different examples of that. I mean, you had that first one, Robert Coles, you know, who's American. He won the Pulitzer Prize for, he's a child psychologist, and he wrote about children going through resignation. And see, because once you resign and decide never to look at the subject again, as all adults have been through this tight corner when they're 15 or something, then you're part of the problem. You don't want to, so you're on an escapist trip, you're superficially not going to go and look deeper and again, you know. And so kids know, because they start thinking about the human condition, and they know adults can't relate to them. So they're in their room with their earphones on and going crazy, and they're wrestling with the human condition. And they've given up trying to. I mean, their parents love them, they love their parents, but they know for some reason no one's talking about this subject. It's off limits. So they're just in, but they're still looking at it. They can still see the imperfections of human life. And you know, so Robert Coles wrote this really powerful little piece. I mean, my view, I think any great literature or poetry or music or art, you know, is only really great if it does venture near the truth of the human condition, bring out some truth. And I wouldn't be surprised if Robert Coles didn't get the Pulitzer Prize for this one particular paragraph. It's so beautiful and so precious, the honesty in it. So I'll just quickly go through it. So he wrote, I tell of the loneliness many young people feel. They get lonely because no one can, dealing with what they can see. They can see the imperfections of human life, you know, the incredible, you know, artificiality and madness and chaos and brutality and vindictiveness and anger, all this, the huge imperfections of human behaviour. And he says it's a loneliness that has to do with a self-imposed judgment. See, what happens at around kids when they're about in their late childhood stage, they actually are starting to encounter the imperfections of life under the duress of the human condition. And they're starting to get frustrated by it. And even by, you get the naughty nines where they start to lash out at the world. And and in frustration at the imperfections and the chaos and the madness. And but what happens at around 12, something very significant psychologically happens. They actually change pace. They realise it's getting you nowhere, flailing out of the world. You're going to have to sit down and try and make sense. Why is the world so imperfect? Why is there all this artificiality and madness and chaos and anger and frustration and selfishness and meanness? Because they can still see that. They haven't resigned yet to blocking out the issue of the human condition. So for them, it's right there. They can see it starkly. And so they're still looking at it. And so they change from being a protesting, demonstrative extrovert to a sobered, introspective adolescent. And we actually change the description from childhood to adolescence. And have you ever thought why? It's because something big happens psychologically. And teachers hate teaching, you know, 9, 10. You know, when they get to 12-year-olds, there's a whole change. They're easy to handle. They're immensely manageable. And there's a reason for that. They've changed from being this protesting to trying to figure it out, why the world isn't right. So they start thinking deeply about the imperfection of human life. And they keep thinking about it. And it progresses from thinking about the imperfection of the world and gradually starts to focus on the issue, not the human condition now, but the human condition they're in, their own imperfection. Now, when they start looking into that, because they've come into the world in the human condition, they've suffered all the imperfections, so they're full of angers, egocentricities, and indifferences, and meanness, and selfishness, and that there's a huge amount of imperfection in their own life. And when they try to face that, that's suicidally depressing. That's unbearable without the explanation of the human condition, which is what chapter 2 of my book presents. If you haven't got the answers to that, all you're facing is that we're a rotten species, and I'm rotten as well. I'm a bad, evil person. And that's unbearable. If you try to face that honestly without any defense against it, if you're still keeping the doors open and you're truthful, that will lead to suicidal depression. That's how terrible the issue of the human condition is, if you don't have any defenses protecting you. And children haven't. They haven't learned them yet. They have to learn them. Each generation has to learn them. They have to go through this process. And so... children are locked in their room, you know, so we can understand what Coles is saying. I tell the loneliness many people feel, they can't discuss this. It's a loneliness that has to do with self-imposed judgment, so they're starting to confront the human condition within themselves. I remember a young man of 15 who engaged in light banter, only to shut down, shake his head, refuse to talk at all when his own life and troubles became the subject at hand. He had stopped going to school. He sat in his room for hours listening to rock music. The door closed. I asked him about his head-shaking behaviour. I wondered whom he was thereby addressing. He replied, "No one." I hesitated, gulped a bit, and took a chance. "Not yourself." He looked straight at me now in a sustained stare. "For the first time, why do you say that?" he asked. I decided not to answer the question in the manner in which I was trained. He's a professor, which is basically to deny the human condition. Yeah. Instead, with some unease, I heard myself saying this: "I've been there. I remember being there. Remember when I felt I couldn't say a word to anyone?" The young man kept staring at me, didn't speak. When he took his handkerchief out and wiped his eyes, I realised they'd begun to fill. Now, what had happened? Coles had reached him with some honesty about what he was actually wrestling with, that he'd given up believing that anyone would ever even recognise. And, you know, some honesty about what the boy could see, which is the struggle, you know, he was struggling with the horror, the utter hypocrisy of human behaviour. And that little bit of honesty kind of saved his life, because someone had been honest what he was could see, and that was so precious to him. He started crying. And there's lots of other examples in here. There's another one. One of the most famous books written in America, literature, is Catcher in the Rye. You probably all read it when you were kids. Anyway, it's an absolutely wonderful book. It's about someone going through, a kid going through resignation. I mean, it's just 16-year-old Holden Caulfield, right? And he's just in total protest. He's going in the midst of resignation. They're all fake. Phony is the word. Phony, phony. They're all phonies. They're artificial, dishonest. They're pretending. They're not being honest about anything. They're an escapist bender. Because when you resign and never going to go near that dark court again, like, even 2 days after someone has actually hit that dark corner and decided never to visit, because it's so depressing, they never visited again. 2 days later, they can hardly remember. It was so terrifying, in such a dark corner, that they decide never to go near. So they're on an escapist mission ever after. More parties, escape, don't think, you know, just escape. So post-resignation, you know, our whole attitude changes. Instead of being honest and thoughtful and profound, we become escapers, evasive, seeking power, fame, fortune, glory, anything to give us some reinforcement, sense of self-worth, any artificial reinforcement, because we can't get the real reinforcement, which would be to understand ourselves. So I'm coming along and presenting the actual understanding. If you listen to the videos on our website, we only interviewed a couple of weeks ago with Brian Carlin, one of Sydney's leading radio journalists. He was the spoon man of Triple M for many years. And he read one of my early books, and I did an interview. It went for 2 hours. It was just amazing. And he transformed. You want to listen to it, you just can't stop talking. I can't hardly stop talking. He just can't. He says, look, I have to deal with people ringing me all day long. And I, because I've got your insight into what's going on in human brain, it's so helpful. In the first few minutes, I can see through where they're coming from. It's that transformative. I can make sense of it, human behavior at last. That's how powerful this chapter 2, when you get to it, is finally having an explanation that makes sense of the dark side of ourselves. So, and you'll see Brian Tartan will say, Jeremy, you've got to take this to 15-year-olds. Because he remembered big time going through resignation. He talks about it, you know, how terrible it was. He said, I was searching everything for some answers. He said, I read every damn book I could get my hands on. But you've got to remember that all the books we've got, I mean, there's mountains of them, libraries of them out there, at Sydney University, and New South Wales University out that window there. And they're, but they're all written from inside the cave, in denial of the human condition, not wanting to face the human condition. So they're going to be very artfully escapist and not really honest. And when you're unresigned, you can tell the world that this is all bullshit. They're not being fair dinkum. They're on a mission to escape the human condition, not confront it. They're not really wanting to be honest at all. And so you've got this perfect ship detector when you're unresigned, when you're a kid, you know. And so Brian Carlin so I grabbed every damn book, every philosophy, psychology, I read the lot, and I couldn't get any answers. I got so desperate, I was reading the encyclopedia to try to find some answers. And so he said, Jeremy, you've got to get this book to pre-resigned adolescents, because they'll soak it up. They're desperate to get some real answers. Great literature or art is what I suggest, where people have dared to relate, go near the fire, this forbidden subject, and bring some truth to it, some relief, some honesty to it. So as I said in this picture of Bacon's picture of the human condition, this self-portrait, you know, it's just frightful, you know, all the running, the faces running together, and it's unmistakable, the agony of the human condition. Bacon's twisted and smudged and distorted, death mask-like. Alienated faces and tortured, contorted, stomach knotted, arms pinned, psychologically strangled and imprisoned bodies. So that brought the biggest price at auction ever at that time, next only to Edward Munch's Scream, which is obviously another picture of the human condition. And the most highest price ever paid for a work of art at auction at that time, which is a huge amount of money, $240 million or something, was for someone being truthful about the human condition. But people go and look at Bacon's pictures and say, look, it's enigmatic and, you know, he's got a dark view of the world and you know, I can't relate to that, and, you know, he must have had a really bad morning when he painted that and stuff like that. But if you think deeply about that, why are people saying this is worth so much money? Because underneath our denial, we actually know what's true and what isn't. And we know that what he's done there is pretty accurate. That's how messed up we are.
He read the Communist Manifest just because his sister told him, you should read it if you want to know history.
Sorry, say that again.
He read the Communist Manifest?
The Communist Manifest, yes.
Yeah, just 2 weeks before ago, because his older sister told him that if you really want to know history, you have to start with this.
Yeah.
And he did. And then he came back talking like you said, oh my God, I'm glad you told me. Yeah. And I'm glad I read it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the age when they really actually read this stuff.
Searching for some
he
truth.
Would read it.
So is the Communist Manifesto got some real truth in it? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm not very big in history, but they talk to each other because three of my kids, they like history a lot.
Yes, yes.
And they kind of, he has two older sisters, and he tries to learn from them.
Yes.
What did they go through and how did they made it easier for themselves?
Yes.
And that's where, and I said, I have read for myself when I was in high school.
Yes.
So.
But is there something sort of very authentic in that?
It is. It is very small, but actually it has so much truth in there.
Well, let's imagine, I haven't read that, but I can imagine what's in it, which would be if everyone cooperates and shares and is selfless and considerate of each other, the world would be a better place, right? And for an unresigned adolescent, that would be truthful. That why is the world so mean and selfish and brutal? And it's not, you know. So that would represent something, sort of, some idealism that they could identify with. You can understand that. But you'll read in chapter 2 that we had to fly off course. Adam Stork had to fly off course, search for knowledge, suffer becoming angry, egocentric and alienated. And then when he's got to have something to sustain him while he's living in that state of dishonesty. So he needs artificial reinforcement. He needs materialism. He needs to feel good about himself. He needs, nice cut suit. He needs, defining white, Marlon Brando shirt or tweet, nice jewelry or lovely dress. We need our material thing to make ourselves better about ourselves while we couldn't defend ourselves. So materialism has a very important role to play. So, and capitalism or money was needed to supply that materialism. So once you admit that we did have to fly off course, did have to suffer becoming angry, egocentric and alien, then it's justified that we had a few chandeliers in our life, and sure, they caused inequality. I mean, this watch, you could probably feed a mob of starving Ethiopians with that's about 10 starving Ethiopians in that, it's only Swatch or something, but I mean, we're full of dishonesties and fraudulences and stuff. So you can imagine the Communist Manifesto would probably be very appealing in that sense. But anyway, chapter 2 will explain this. This is a defense of materialism, and because we had to, while we couldn't have spiritualism, that is, spirit meaning mind, understanding of our condition. All we had was material way to reinforce a big house, feel good about ourselves, big car, good suit, whatever, to make ourselves feel better about ourselves. So this is a defense of materialism. It defends humans. It says we're good and not bad, and makes sense of that. And so these false starts to an ideal world, like communism and socialism and so forth, and Marxism, were actually false starts. Adam Stork can't fly back on course and give in search for knowledge. Stop becoming suffering. Marching into hell for a heavenly cause. He had to find the heavenly cause, which is the understanding that would defend himself, and then and only then would it be legitimate to fly back on course and sort of become ideally behaved. We had to suffer becoming upset in order to find sufficient knowledge to explain ourselves, and then and only then was it legitimate to fly back on course, to give up the corrupting search for knowledge. So this says, now materialism had a very important role to play. This is a defense of materialism and individualism and the search for knowledge and everything that went with it. And we can understand that about ourselves now, the need for some luxury and some comfort and some relief from the agony of the human condition. So this is, when it got really extreme, then there were going to be some people like Marx that are going to pop up and say, look, enough's enough, there's too much greed here, everyone share, and everyone ticks that box, says, we all share, it'd be great. But you haven't got rid of the human condition. People are going to start sharing, and they're going to be still mean and bitter and twisted and unhappy and suffering with the human condition inside. So after a little while, they're going to start ripping the system off and sharing their potatoes behind the scenes and getting some money to, and the whole communist system will collapse because they haven't got rid of the human condition. They haven't found the dignifying understanding that allow it to end. So so these are false starts to a human condition free world. The only way we are ever going to get them is through knowledge, understanding of ourselves, like the temples and ancients had, man, know thyself, understand. You've got to find knowledge. You know, we needed brain food, not brain anesthetic, you know. Stopping the brain thinking is to deny being what we are, human. We've got to find knowledge. We've got to get out of this cave through finding understanding. We want answers. We want brain food. So that's what this book supplies, answers. So that's what this book is all about. So this is this heavy metal band called With Life in Mind. And clearly these are the words of an unresigned adolescent who hasn't given in yet and hadn't become fake and phony. He's seeing the world for real. So this is a real description of our world for someone who can still see it the way it really is. When we resign, we can't see it like it is. These are terrifying words, but they're dead accurate. Like Artie Lang, you know, who rolled around drunk as a skunk, you know, rather than... He said, look, mate, I'm just going to tell the truth. Someone's got to tell some truth around here. I'm just sick of it. But this is this kid who wrote With Life in Mind. It scares me to death to think what I have become. So he'd be very honest about himself. I feel lost in this world. Our innocence is lost. I scream to the sky, but my words get lost along the way. I can't express all the hate that's led me here and all the filth that swallows us whole. I don't want to be part of this insanity, famine, death, pestilence, and war, which are the four apocalypse of the four horsemen of the apocalypse or something. A world shrouded in darkness. Fear is driven into our minds everywhere we look, trying so hard for a life with so little purpose, lost in oblivion. Everything you've been told has been a lie, same as what Artie Lang said, you know. We've all been asleep since the beginning of time. They're almost the same words as Artie Lang. Why are we so scared to use our minds? Again, now we can understand why. Keep pretending. Soon enough, things will crumble to the ground. If they could only see the truth, they would coil in disgust. How do we save ourselves from this misery? So desperate for the answers. We're straining on the last bits of hope we have left. No one hears our cries, and no one sees us screaming. This is the end. So desperate for the answers. So that's an unresigned brain talking to us about the horror that they can see, about the madness of the world, which we can no longer see once you're on the other side of the resignation. That's what we would say would be our conscience, that we get, we can all work out rationally that ideally it would be better if everyone was cooperative and loving and selfless, you know. Like that, it's a fairly obvious ideal. And so you could say we've got a conscience, a moral sense, just from being rational, from looking at the ideal would be if everyone was cooperative and loving, like communism, so everyone shares everything. But it's universally accepted that we've got an altruistic moral nature, an instinct which our conscience is the voice of, the expression of within us. And so that we're born with this instinctive propensity to be able to, like this footballer I use in the book, who gave his life trying to save some kids, you know, and he couldn't even swim. He said, I've got to go and try and help them. And he actually died trying to save these kids in this big pond. And it's universally accepted that we've got this moral nature, but how did we acquire it? That's the great mystery, because all these biological theories that they've used are actually human condition avoiding theories. So that's why the latter part of chapter one is so important, because it presents the explanation of how we acquired altruistic moral instincts, but not using a human condition avoiding explanation. See, that's what the whole thing I was trying to explain with the book is. I was trying to explain how once you understand that humans are living in fear of the human condition, so people in the cave are living in fear of the human condition in Plato's cave, they've developed all these theories that want to avoid the human condition, not confront it. So they're dishonest theories, right? And I just gave you the example of evolutionary psychology that says, sure, bees give their life because they're fostering their own reproduction by fostering the queen.
Yeah.
But then to extrapolate that and say that when we behave selflessly towards others, like the guy, that footballer that gave his life trying to save those kids, he's actually trying to foster, you know, his genes in the offspring, in those that are related to him, which just doesn't make sense. I mean, those kids obviously then they'd say, well, that's just an aberration of the basic idea that that's what where people are when they're being selfless, they are trying to... So there's a huge flaw in that argument. So what happened then, you'll see if you read the end of chapter one, is that they switched and tried to come up with another theory, which E.O. Wilson's come up with. They tried to say, okay, that true. We've used that lie long enough. It's not working. Let's find another one.
Yeah.
And they've come up with another. It's even shonkier. It's even more clever, but it's still avoiding the human condition. So if you go to chapter four,
yeah,
supposedly it will explain the real reason that how we acquired our moral nature in a human condition confronting truthful manner, right? So that's the thesis of the whole book. Establish that humans are living in denial and can't face the truth in which. So everything they're saying and all their theories are human condition avoiding, right?
Yeah.
And now we'll go through and look at all these big questions and not avoid the human condition. We'll make sense of them. So what happens when you get to chapter four? So it's this massive question. How did we acquire our unconditionally selfless moral nature, right? This, that our conscience is the voice of within us, that we're all born with kind of thing. We all have this ability. Yeah. And it says that the real reason was through nurturing, which the bonobo is a living example of it occurring.
Right.
Now, the reason that's human condition avoiding and never been admitted, it was actually admitted some 10 years or so, or 12 years after Darwin's Origin of Species was published, and it was actually described as a theory far more important than natural selection. You'll see John Fiske admitted it. It's in chapter 5. Look up John Fiske. But that theory was let die, right? Because of the human condition, fear of the human condition. Because if it's true that nurturing made us human, and that nurturing therefore is the most important ingredient in why making us human and our growing up and stuff, it confronts parents with their present inability to nurture their children as much as they were before the human condition. So, as I say in the book, you know, parents would rather admit to being an axe murderer than a bad parent. So it's an unbearable truth. First, explain the human condition, the good reason for our upset, corrupted, angry, egocentric, and then we can safely admit all these other truths. So this is what Artie Lang said. This is how honest he is. I mean, he's this wild psychologist. Harry Prosen, he wrote those wonderful combinations, actually had him at one of his universities. Harry's in charge of a lot of universities, a psychology department once. And Artie Lang turned up and he was absolutely pissed, rotten drunk. And he staggered around the stage, fell over. It was just so embarrassing for everybody. But that's how honest this bloke was. I absolutely love him because he let the truth out. He was just fearless. He just said, look, I just see so much suffering every day with all the people coming in and needing psychological help. And he's a brilliant psychologist. He used to get down on the floor and have these sort of empathetic experiences with them. And because he shared their pain and they were in, you know, crawling with pain, and he could reach them. And Harry Prosen's is like that. He can read some stories about Harry in here, how empathetic he is. And so Artie Lang was just fearlessly honest. But he was self-destructive. He was so honest. He just couldn't care less. And this is what he said about humans. He said, our alienation goes to the roots. The realization of this is the essential springboard for any serious reflection on any aspect of present interhuman life. He's saying, if we don't recognize this alienation, this state of denial, we're not going to get anywhere. So he's saying exactly what Plato said, you know, they're all lying, living in a cave, you know, but so you've got to live outside the cave, you've got to get to the truth. The ordinary person is a shriveled, desiccated fragment of what a person can be. The condition of alienation, of being asleep, of being out, being unconscious, of being out of one's mind, is the condition of the normal man. Between us and our true self or soul, there's a veil which is more like 50 foot of solid concrete. What did Artie Lang said? 50 foot of solid concrete. We're not going to go near that subject ever again. Between us and our true selves or soul, there's a veil, like 50 foot of solid. The outer divorce from any illumination from the inner is a state of darkness. We are in an age of darkness. The state of outer darkness is the state of sin, alienation or estrangement from the inner light. We are murderers and prostitutes. We are bemused and crazed creatures, strangers to our true selves and to one another. We are dead but think we are alive. We are asleep but think we are awake. We are dreaming but take our dreams to be reality. We are the halt, lame, blind, deaf, the sick. We are doubly unconscious. We are so ill that we no longer feel ill, as there's many terminal illnesses. We are mad but have no insight into the fact of our madness. We are so out of touch with this realm where the human condition is, many people argue that seriously doesn't even exist. That's what I'm trying to break through, the 50-foot solid wall of concrete to this realm that everyone is living in denial even exists, and reconnect this with it. Because once I can get that reconnection in place, then I can go through the rest of it and unpack everything, and you'll be astonished. So I'll take on all these great issues and I'll explain them, but from a non-denial, human condition confronting honest perspective, and it'll all unravel. So Catcher in the Rye is this amazing story. It's the most wonderful story to read. It's so magically written, because he takes the, you know, this Colden Caulfield, he gives him this voice of this frustrated, lonely church teenager, you know, keeps getting Catcher in the Rye. It's just unbelievable stuff. Surrounded by phonies, morons, never want to discuss any, adults who never want to discuss anything, and live on the opposite side of the pole to where I'm living. I just didn't like anything that was happening, because it's also fraudulent and dishonest. And wanting to escape to somewhere with a brook where I could chop my own wood and stuff in winter. He knows he's supposed to resign. In the novel, he talks about being told that life is a game, you should play it according to the rules, and feeling so damn lonesome and depressed, and even committing suicide. As a result of the disenchantment with the world, he keeps failing all his subjects and making no effort at all. And I swear to God, I'm a madman. I know I'm very hard to talk to, because he's living in a different paradigm to everybody else. He's still saying, you're all fake and funny, and no one's admitting it, you know, and you're all laughing and making jokes and let's go to a party and do this and, you know, buy some more blue shoes and blah, 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 you know. And they're saying, no one's being fair dinkum here. And he had the same experience that Robert Coles had with that Addison with Robert Coles. He ran into an adult who actually ratted on this denial and admitted it, it's going on, and that bit of honesty saved his life. So this is what this adult said. He finally found this adult, right? This is what the adult said. This fall, I think you're riding for, it's a special kind of fall, a horrible kind, where you just keep falling and falling, obviously utter depression. The adult then spoke of men who at some time or other in their lives were looking for something their own environment couldn't supply them with, so they gave up looking, as they resigned. Adding, you'll find that you're not the first person who was ever confused and frightened and even sickened by human behaviour. So yes, you know, to be confused, frightened to the point of being sickened by human behaviour is what a resigned adolescent is looking at. And so that adult, and that's saved his life. That made all the difference. Because every day he's walking around, running into adults, looking at them and saying, can't you see what I can see? And they can't, and it's driving him crazy. And one day somebody is a little bit honest to him, and it damn well saved his life. And the book's called Catcher in the Rye because he says at the end of the book, I just want to be... He has this vision. I keep picturing all these little kids playing some game in this big field of rye grass and all. Thousands of little kids and nobody's around. Nobody, adults I mean, except me. And I'm standing on the edge of some crazy cliff. What I have to do, I have to catch everybody if they start to go over the cliff. So he's saying, I just want to be the catcher in the rye that stops the kids resigning, having to die. And so, because when you resign, you give up thinking truthfully because you're going to be fake and artificial and superficial thereafter. I mean, once you resign, I mean, there's this huge elephant in our room, which is this issue of the human condition, the imperfection. No one's admitting it, even admitting it. So everyone's walking around, there's this giant elephant. It's filling the whole damn room. It's the real subject. Which is what I said at the beginning. To explain human behavior, you've got to talk about this bloody elephant. But no one's even aware that it's there. This is what happens after resignation, because any thinking is going to bring you into contact with the human condition. I mean, like I used the example, look, there's a lovely tree, or, you know, there's a wonderful sunrise or something. And, you know, you start thinking about that and you think, gee, it's amazing how beautiful nature can be. And the next thing is, wonder why I'm not beautiful inside, full of all these angst and, you know, indifferences to others and meanness and anger and, you know, at least, then you're back in confronting the human condition. And William Wordsworth had it in one of his poems. To me, the meanest flower that blows can bring, give thoughts that do often too lie too deep for tears. They're so profound, so unsettling. Even the meanest flower. So, you know, it's true that even the plainest flower can remind us of the unbearably depressing issue of our seemingly horribly imperfect human condition. And as one contact said, you know, thinking can get you into terrible downward spirals of doubt. One way to stop us behaving so aggressively was to stop living through our upset conscious state, but to defer to something else that was supposedly more honest than we were and to live through them. And so that was the religion, where you deferred to some great prophet that clearly wasn't full of all this upset, and through them you could find yourself at peace again because you're not living out your upset. So the criticism of Genghis Khan and sort of Hitler or whatever would be that they didn't become deeply religious in that sense. Sure, religions became fanatical and the whole thing got out of control again later on. But there is these... religions eventually became too condemning, too confronting, because you had to admit all this guilt and stuff. And so people got sick of that. And then we got into these... even more pseudo-idealistic, because they're not genuinely idealistic. You're still very upset, but you're now deferring to like Homer Simpson and what's his name? Ned Flanders. See, Ned's born-again Christian, and Bart's still out there conquering the world, and he's full of madness. Let's go to Las Vegas and get ripped off, and let's try to get Ned drunk. And Ned's born-again Christian. He's a goody-goody. But Bart's still Adam Stork in full flight. Homer, you know, Ned is actually a very even more upset than Homer, but he's found this faith that he lives through rather than living through himself, and so he defers to that, and then he's finding a force for good, right? So people, and then we've got sort of environmentalism, which doesn't have the guilt involved, where you could do good things and save a tree and whatever, or threaten a species and feel good about that. So we got desperate to find some relief from the guilt, from the human condition. And so you get the situation where people are doing good for the ulterior motive of make themselves feel good, is to relieve themselves of the human condition. So that's that subtlety that comes in later on. The fundamental situation is, yes, our goody-goody instincts, Rousseau-type instincts, condemn our conscious mind search for knowledge, and we unavoidably have to become defensive and retaliatory and egocentric and so on. And so our instincts are criticising us there, but when you're born again later on, the very end of this horrific journey of ever-increasing levels of upset, it gets so bad that then people start doing good, not because their instincts are criticising them, their instincts are telling them to be good, but because they want to feel good, they want relief from the human condition. It's a very different equation. So the whole thing gets compounded, and one thing, level of upset's happening on top of another. But yeah, the last 2,000 years, the last 11,000 years since agriculture and domestication of animals, and then even in the last 200 years, I think the last 200 years is the final section of chapter 7, is really where upset is just going through the roof. And then everyone is an absolute bender to try to find some escape from who they are, from the darkness inside themselves, and they find enormous relief from taking up some moral cause that might make them feel some sense of goodness. If you're feeling that dark about yourself, if you can find a cause that saving the environment or whatever, the rush you get from doing good at last. But so the thing is, though, there were false starts to a sort of free will, because you have like the Adam Stork situation. Anytime Adam Stork could fly back on course and feel good about himself, like he's obeying his instincts, in our case being cooperative and loving instincts, but he's actually being irresponsible because he's given up the search for knowledge. See, that's the problem with pseudo-idealism. Religion saved humanity, I argue in the book, because it gave us a way to defer to something better than ourselves when we could no longer afford to live out who we were. So we were so destructive, so upset. But it is a false form of, we're not, our real self hasn't been healed at all. We're just giving up, letting it have its day. So in fact, you know, if Homer could explain himself again with Ned, you know, he would say, listen, Ned, you're a goody-goody two-shoes and Huey loves you and you love Huey, God or whatever, you know, but I'm out there doing it. I'm going to Las Vegas next week and we're going to, you know, party up and I'm, blah, 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 and I'm giving Lisa a hard time and Bart an even worse time and, you know, so, but I'm out there doing it, mate. I'm a hero. I'm the Adam Stork flying off course. So I'm still participating in the heroic search for knowledge. And so, but with understanding in chapter two, old Homer could finally, because Ned's driving him crazy. Ned's a goody-goody, and he's got this really conceited, you know, moral high ground, sort of, and looking down on Homer is, Homer borrows his mower and smashes it up and doesn't tell him, and, you know, it's just crazy. There's no reconciling understanding between the two. I mean, Homer knows intuitively that Ned's bullshitting, that he's not really sound, that he's actually being religious because he's unsound, you know. It's the opposite of what he's deluding himself, that he's moral high ground and I'm a goody. You're not, mate. But he can't explain it. But that's what happens when you can finally explain the human condition. You can finally reveal the real game plans going on behind everything. But it's actually compassionate because then Ned could respond, you know, and say, but that's the responsible thing I had to do when I became so upset. I had to find something that I could live through that saved me from myself, you know. And maybe, Bart, you're so destructive, you should give it some decent thought. But what you'll read in chapter 8, which it says is a new way of coping, where we don't have to have these false ways of pseudo-idealistic ways to feel good about ourselves. We can actually ameliorate or heal the confusion in our mind and subside it, which is what Anna was saying is happening at a rapid rate. So much more, she says, I've got to slow up and let this go through my filters, you know. And Bart's opening comment, you know, was, you've got to make this video available to everybody trying to read this book, you know. It'll help a lot. If that's what... We wanted a real form of relief from the pain in the brain, something that made sense. And I was saying to Craig that he has a very rigorous mind. He's not going to take a step that doesn't stack up and make... And so he's got these fundamental questions, and they're really good questions. And I said, you shouldn't move one inch on anything until you're totally satisfied that it actually works. But I've got no fear because he's extremely rational and cautious and skeptical and so on, which is great, but yeah, I mean, this either stacks up or it doesn't, so that was one question about instincts is about people. It's complex because people do it now for not in the original way. They're doing it to feel good sometimes, so it's hard to work out what they're doing. What was the other question you had?
I found it quite easy to understand and really engaging. Actually, I really like the book. Well, I recently finished a degree and in that I was a Bachelor of Arts in Sustainable Development. So we learn about a mechanistic worldview, and I found it was really relevant actually the reading this book, because it was sort of like a review of what I'd been through recently. And that's why I found it really enjoyable actually. So I look forward to checking out the rest of the book. A lot of, as I said previously, that I just finished a degree, so a lot of the talk about like a mechanistic worldview, that was already relatively fresh in my mind. So I was fairly receptive to a lot of what was written in chapter one. And then I noticed at the end of chapter two that I sort of jumped the gun a bit when I said that you were bashing like the mechanistic worldview, because you mentioned it at the end of chapter two, that as
a result of their work.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's sort of, human rights.
Yeah, I was a bit ahead of myself. I consider these ideas on a daily basis. So when I read that, I was fairly receptive to the ideas.
Yeah.
And I like the idea of, because no one's providing any alternative view. So I like the idea that you're presenting something, an alternative explanation, rather than the continuation of one specific paradigm. So, I mean, I like the idea of the paradigm shift and trying to create the shift. So it's definitely something that I've been thinking about prior to and in a and continuing on from the reading.
Yeah.